Anne Lamott's spiritual journey unfolds not as a dramatic leap, but as a series of staggers from one safe place to another. Growing up in Tiburon with intellectual, atheist parents, young Anne secretly prayed at night, convinced someone was listening. Her first sanctuary was found in her Catholic friend's chaotic home with their glamorous mother, so different from her practical atheist mother. Another refuge appeared in her friend Shelley's home, where Shelley's Christian Scientist mother Lee gathered neighborhood children like a marmy figure, introducing Anne to radical ideas that God was both father and mother, and that Anne was beautiful despite her wild hair and awkward body. When nighttime fears overwhelmed her, Lee would lie beside her whispering the 23rd Psalm, helping her find green pastures inside. These seemingly random stopping points, Catholic homes, Christian Science teachings, Jewish traditions, formed the unlikely path that eventually led her to faith. Each lily pad, however flimsy, held her up just long enough for her to reach the next one. At 28, Anne moved to Tiburon, devastated by her father's death from brain cancer. Her days followed a grim pattern. Waking hungover, writing briefly, then secretly replacing her friend's scotch. Making only $7,000 that year, she spiraled through bulimia, drinking, and affairs with unavailable men. In photos, she looked skinny and furtive beside her healthy friend Pammy, like someone trying to disappear. Believing death was near, she called Bill Rankin, the new priest at St. Stephen's. When she confessed that God couldn't love her, he replied simply, "God has to love you. That's God's job." Her darkness deepened in 1984 when she became pregnant while living in a Sausalito houseboat. After her abortion, she drank heavily. One night, bleeding badly, she became aware of Jesus sitting in her room. Though she told him, "I would rather die," he persisted, like a little cat wanting to be let in. Finally, after another Sunday at church, she surrendered. "Fuck it, I quit. All right, you can come in." Crisis creates unexpected bonds. On a turbulent flight, terrified flyer Anne distracted fellow passengers by sharing magazines and chocolates. Seated between a Latvian woman and a man reading religious fiction, she recalled witnessing a touching moment at church, a standoffish choir member embracing a dying AIDS patient as they sang. When another passenger had a heart attack, her row of strangers found surprising laughter amid chaos. Different turbulence came with her friend Pammy's death from breast cancer. 3 months later, in Ixtapa with her toddler Sam, grief cycled between heaviness, rage, and numbness. Though hesitant to revisit memory-laden places, she found unexpected joy watching a one-legged man climb the trapeze with disjointed grace. On her final day, while snorkeling in dreamy silence, she cried for Pammy but felt uplifted by others' courage and joy. Though Sam resists going to church despite his mother's prepared diversions, Anne insists because St. Andrew's gave her essential support when she was struggling. 7 months before Sam's birth, elderly congregants secretly helped her financially, especially Mary Williams, an octogenarian who brings dimes and calls Sam our baby. He hugs her every Sunday while she praises God and smells behind his ears where he most smells like sweet, unwashed new potatoes. This sacred community extends beyond church walls. When their friend's daughter, Olivia, was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, the congregation rallied around the family, raising money, cleaning, providing childcare, and offering both companionship and space to grieve. For Anne, church isn't just about buildings or rituals. It's about a community that shows up when needed most. 2 weeks after sharing a stage with her hero Grace Paley, Anne was devastated by their failed performance. She dominated their unscripted conversation, even being called shrill and narcissistic by an audience member. While Grace shrugged it off, it was what it was, Anne was crushed. Alone in her hotel room, she whispered, "Help." She recalled a priest's wisdom that grace means accepting being ineffective and foolish. Through failure, she found freedom and vulnerability. For their second performance, she simply stuck to prepared talks, and the evening succeeded. Grace was honest and tough, inspiring everyone to fight the good fight. Anne had wanted to be beside Charisse, seeking acclaim, but what she got was Grace, lovely in her faded dress and dark socks, smiling warmly. This lesson in imperfection carried into parenting. When Sam's concerning blood test triggered her anxiety, she prayed for faith and humor. Like the prophet Elijah finding God in the still small voice, she found comfort in simple things: smoothies with bananas, the only known cure for existential dread, and ordinary rituals. Anne found herself scrutinizing her middle-aged appearance after developing feelings for a man recently out of a relationship with a younger woman. Despite her feminist and religious beliefs, she felt reduced to her physical packaging, her skin, hair, and body shape. While watching Lachodrom, a film about gypsies, she observed exhausted middle-aged mothers like herself, but also old women who danced with incredible spirit. These crones, having stopped chasing validation, radiated a freed life force. Anne realized she contained both her younger self and future crone within. She yearned for their wisdom, the deep breaths, careful observation, and acceptance that life isn't about doing. Her body's wisdom extended to food, too. After years of eating disorders and recovery, work with Rita Grossman helped her finally recognize true hunger and feed herself appropriately. Learning to eat became a choice to live. At the beach near San Quentin Prison, Anne froze when a man was beating his golden retriever. When Sam begged her to intervene, she managed only a weak stop. Another mother joined in, threatening police. The man laughed menacingly before leaving. Sam asked if the dog would always stay with that man. Anne assured him it wouldn't, though uncertain why she believed this. She felt ashamed, remembering a friend who'd thrown himself under a rearing horse to save a child. August brought compounding losses: a failed romance, her friend Mary Williams' death at 86, and a relative's Alzheimer's diagnosis. Her friend Neshama suggested hiking to a marsh that looked like Mesopotamia accidentally deposited amid suburban buildings. Deep in the marsh, Anne lost her expensive sandals in mud. While helping Neshama up a slope, she grabbed a failing root, sending them both sliding down. Seeing her friend's pristine dress now mud-covered, Anne erupted in laughter. It felt freeing to be so old, so muddy, with no pretenses left. This became her deepest spiritual truth. Even when we doubt love's power to conquer all, it does anyway. It follows us into the darkest places, and there it swells and comforts. Our spirits don't rise until we descend into the mud, because that's where everything begins.